Welcome to Animals to the Max. I'm your host, Corbin Maxey. This show is about animals and the people who dedicate their lives to them. Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of the Animals to the Max podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Maxey. Thank you so much for hanging out with me today. I have a question for you. How do you land your dream job working with animals? Your dream job traveling the world. How do people do it? You know, honestly, the behind-the-scenes stories of successful people traveling the world and working with animals is one of the main reasons why I decided to start the Animals to the Max podcast all the way back in 2017. In over 200 episodes of the podcast, that's what I love hearing. I love that backstory just to get some inspiration and try to, you know, help people out there who are possibly wanting to pursue a career working with animals and to figure out, like, how did these people do it? And I'm so excited on today's show. We get to hear from the person living his dream. On the show, I have Jake Willers. Jake is an award-winning wildlife filmmaker. He's a Nat Geo TV presenter and host of Behind the Wild Lens podcast. I am so happy that Jake is on the show. Jake gives all the insight on how he became an award-winning wildlife filmmaker. This guy just got done filming black bears for BBC's Planet Earth 3. He's traveled the world, 38 countries, a lot of valuable bombs in here. Now, before we get to the interview, I just want to say thank you and welcome to all of you who are joining us on our 2024 Luxury South African Safari. The trip completely sold out. I'm like so excited. It's our first safari hosting, people, and I cannot wait to take you to one of my favorite places in the whole entire world, the Manuleti Game Reserve, right outside of Kruger National Park. And then we're going to go to Simonstown and see endangered African penguins. And then some of us are going to go over to Zambia and see Vic Falls. Like, I'm so excited. Anyway, if you're not on the trip and you're wondering, Corbin, like, why are you talking about a trip I'm not going on? I just wanted to ask you, would you be interested in going on a luxury safari? And if you would be interested, if we should plan another one for 2025, send me a quick email. My email is so simple, just corbin@corbinmaxey.com. I also want to recommend all of you who want the full interview to check out the after show. You guys, the after show is where it's at. It's basically behind the scenes interviews that are available to Patreons only. If you want access to all of our after shows, there are a lot of them. All you have to do is head on over to patreon.com/animals2themax. Okay, with that said, let's get to it. Jake, welcome to the show.
Hey, Corbin. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You sound so good. Like, it's like a knife cutting through butter, how good your voice sounds with the podcast setup. I appreciate it so much.
Yeah. Hey, I totally understand. I totally understand. I have a podcast too. And when I reach out to my guests in the reach out email, it has in there, you know, please, if you have headphones or a microphone, please use it. You know, and people turn up and they're just on their iPhone, you know, out in the middle of traffic.
Yeah, it's horrible.
So I get it.
Yeah, I just did. And by the way, your podcast, Behind the Lens podcast, which we'll put the links in the show notes. But yeah, no, I totally get it. My last interview, he was in like this big open room and there was someone grooming a dog in the background. I was like, oh my God, Jared, like it sounded horrible, the audio, but I don't know. It is what it is. But I'm so happy you reached out. I mean, you just, gosh, your credentials are out of this world. And, you know, this podcast is about people and, you know, who dedicate their lives to animals. And I'm always into the backstory of how people are able to get their dream jobs. Because, I mean, you look at your credentials, having been to over 38 countries, you just got done filming Planet Earth 3, doing a, you know, sequence with urban black bears. Like, it sounds just like this dream job. So I just can't wait to dive into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll start back at the beginning, the quick version. You know, I was lucky enough to grow up from about the age of 10 years old on a wildlife park. So my dad started an animal sanctuary when I was 10, and that grew from being an animal sanctuary for native British wildlife. So things like blackbirds and foxes and hedgehogs. That grew to become one of East Anglia's most popular attraction, East Anglia being a large area of the on the east coast of the UK. And now it's an international breeding center for endangered species. It's called Shepworth Wildlife Park. And it has things like Bengal tigers, otters, wolves, everything from, you know, small insects all the way up to the big predators. And so, you know, luck really helped me out there. I had a childhood surrounded by, first of all, kind of native wildlife. And then later on, as I took over and started managing the wildlife park, you know, wild animals, exotic species. I mean, they're captive animals, so we can't really say wild, but they're exotic species. And I had so much contact with them, so much observation, learned their behavior, that it led to, well, it led to me being on TV, but that came about in a fashion that I had no idea was unfolding. So I curated an insect house for the wildlife park. It was kind of an attraction. My passion was bugs, right? I just loved creepy crawlies. And, you know, whenever I traveled anywhere, I was always looking on the ground, you know, what can I find? So I curated this animal house. It got very popular in the first year. We had a production company come along. They wanted to do some interviews with me for some newscasts. And we did the interviews, and I was showing them insects and what have you. And afterwards, they said, wow, we think you'd make a really good presenter for a show. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, no, never thought about it, right? So they went away. A few weeks later, they said, could we film a promo for a TV series? And I'm like, you know, I'm really busy. I don't know how I'm going to fit that in. And anyway, we did it, and I figured, well, if nothing else, you know, it'll be good good practice. So they came along. We did this 5-minute promo, and again, they went away. Didn't hear from them probably for about 3 or 4 months, and then they reached out with a phone call saying, "Hey, guess what? We have a 6-part series on National Geographic Channel with you as the host."
Wow!
And I was like, "Wow, where did that come from?" So, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, a lot of people say, well, you're so lucky, right? And I am absolutely lucky to have been, you know, born into a family that to run a wildlife park, lucky to have those opportunities. But one of the things I always come back to is I say Seneca had a saying about luck is basically where opportunity meets preparation, or preparation meets opportunity. And I think it's so true, because I had focused so heavily on being a wildlife expert at the wildlife park. Mm-hmm. We would have outreach programs with schools. Schools would come to us and we would go to them. And it was a way of life. And so when the opportunity came along, you know, I'd never thought about TV in any way, shape or form, or being on TV. I'd done lots of interviews for news channels and things like that, but just kind of marketing for the wildlife park. But one thing I always had from a very young age in the back of my mind was travel and adventure. I always just, you know, that was something that I just aspired to, is like traveling the world, getting to see incredible wildlife, adventure, just going to new places. And really, I think that's where that preparedness came in when that opportunity came along. It was like, you know, a no-brainer, and it just all fell into place. So so very, very lucky there. And I went on to host multiple TV series with National Geographic Channel originally. Then they launched Nat Geo Wild, of which I was one of the launch, my series, it's called Rogue Raiders, was a launch series in the UK for Nat Geo Wild. And then they were aired in 147 countries on the Nat Geo you know, network, not in North America, because North America has a different schedule than the rest of the world. But yeah, and I, you know, just started traveling the world and getting that adventure and travel. So it was pretty exciting.
That sounds like a dream. And that is very, very lucky, I have to say, because like, I mean, that's very, very lucky. I've been in the media for 20 years. And initially, like that, I feel like every wildlife person on TV, like that's their goal, to get on Animal Planet or National Geographic. And it is hard. And it's crazy. Yeah. People don't know, and I've personally been so close to getting shows, but it's literally like, it's like up to, like at Animal Planet, it's like up to 3 people. It blows my mind how it's such a small unit, but it's a cutthroat business. And so that is amazing to be able to, you know, to get that. Did you grow up like watching any television presenters that inspired you maybe?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, David Attenborough, Sir David, you know, I mean, grew up with all of his shows. And we had, you know, VHS back in the day.
Oh,
VHS
yes.
tapes, right? We had, you know, life, Trials of Life and things like Attenborough shows on, you know, that was our box sets on the VHS recorder back in the days. So, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's... I'd never aspired to doing that. I mean, what I was aspiring to was educating kids, you know, putting, showing my passion for something like insects, which were so vilified, you know, they still are, right? I mean, if you see insects really in a movie, it's always, you know, it's either a giant, you know, spider. Spider's not an insect, I should say that now, but you know, creepy crawlies. Creepy crawlies coming at you, you know, they're vilified. And so I really wanted to be on that bandwagon of showing, look, you know, there might be 4,000 there might be cockroaches that we look at as pests, but what you don't realize is there's about 4,500 to 5,000 species of cockroaches, of which only about 25 of those species are actually pests that we consider. The rest are doing incredible work on a jungle floor, on a forest floor. Without them, we wouldn't be here. So that was my mission. And the first series that we got for National Geographic was Insects from Hell.
Were you in charge of the name?
No, I was just about to say we didn't choose the name. That was National Geographic. But you know how most series just have a working title.
Yeah.
Right? So you're just making a bug show, right? And so it has a working title, and it used to all be very, you know, very top secret, the titles, and it would only be right, you know, close to airing that the title would actually be stated. I'm not sure it's so closely guarded anymore, but so yeah, it was Insects from Hell. We went on to make two seasons of that.
Insects. That did not air in North America. It aired everywhere else except North America. My goodness, of course, we're the ones that are outliers, of course.
Well, you know, at that time, so I was, you know, I was on National Geographic and Steve Irwin was on Animal Planet. It was around that same time.
Oh, really? So like early, late 90s? Early 2000s. So,
yeah, it was around 2001 my first season came out.
Wow.
So we filmed in 2000 and then, 2001. So, really, I think at that time, American networks wanted American presenters. They weren't so into the whole international thing. We tried to, you know, because we were working with Nat Geo in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. That was the headquarters, as well as in London. But there was just, they do focus groups, you know, put people in a room, they show your show, and we would have focus groups put out in the U.S., and the feedback would always be, oh, it's a fantastic show. If we could just have it with an American presenter.
Oh, no. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. So in those early days, it was very much like that before it became, you know, we're now a melting pot. And, you know, I mean, it's great to have just multicultural shows all over the place. And I think streaming has really brought that to the head, you know.
Yeah. Were you ever told by network executives to be more like Steve Irwin? Because I feel like that's like the story of my life until I
all
went
the time.
All the time to pretend to.
It actually is what put me off presenting. Right. And I don't want to make this sound, you know, I know how lucky I am. I get it. But one of the things that really bugged me was execs would come along and they'd go, be more like Steve from the other side of the camera.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in front of the camera. I'm laying on the ground in a 3-foot pile of elephant dung, right? With about 200 dung beetles down my shirt,
so
crawling
cool.
around. And I'd be picking them up, looking and talking. And they would interrupt and go, be more like Steve.
Oh,
man.
That's just...
You know, because...
Crushing.
Well, Steve was, you know, I mean, he was just crushing it on an Animal Planet, and it's all about ratings, right? So everyone wanted their Steve, and I kept going. Afterwards, I would go up to my producer and exec producer, because we had our own producers there, but then on the first show, we had an exec producer come out from National Geographic to make sure everything, we were spending their money right, you know?
Yeah.
And I would go to my producer and say, look, you know, I'm Jake Willers, right? I want to be more like Jake, right? Not more like Steve. I mean, if we all aspire to be like Steve, well, you know, So, Steve, I love Steve. I mean, what an incredible guy. He did so much for wildlife and conservation, but we don't all need to be doing the same thing.
I agree. I was in a meeting one time in like downtown Manhattan with a production company, and my manager's there, and we're, you know, trying to pitch shows and this and that. And my manager's like, Corbin's crazy. He's just like, Steve, he'll, I mean, so she's talking for him and she's like, he'll jump on a great white shark. And I'm just like, in my mind thinking, no, I'm not. Like, what? No, no, not, right. No, yeah. Not at all. And have to do this. And they, God, I even had networks, you know, they say like, oh, you know, grow a beard or try to be this, try to get more jacked to look like what they were looking for. And in the end, I found out something for me personally way better, which is YouTube. And I'm able to reach more people than I ever would have done at that time getting a show. But it's just funny. Everyone said, be more like Steve. And I'm with you. Like, I feel like Steve was one of a kind, and I feel like there'll never be another Steve. And I feel like people should be themselves. And I think coming across authentic is more important than trying to pretend to be someone you're not.
Yeah. Especially nowadays. Right. Yeah. I mean, because we have so many options with, you know, streaming channels, but YouTube, you say, our own distribution. We've got so many options. We want to find something that resonates with us. And that doesn't all, just imagine if every singer tried to be Michael Jackson.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, you would just have no variety, right? It would just get boring after a while. So I think, and of course, there was a plethora of people that were trying to do Steve, you know, after, you know, once YouTube really became, you know, a medium that everyone was turning to, there was lots and lots of people doing that. And after a while, it's kind of like, here's another person just trying to do the Steve Irwin thing. And Steve was Steve. So, you know, and I think he did incredible stuff. Yes, there were times I would look and go, oh, man, I wish he wouldn't grab those snakes like that. Or I wish he wouldn't, you know, do something, because it does send, there are certain people out there who think, oh, that's how you go and, you know, jump on a venomous snake. Or, oh, if you grab a snake by its tail, apparently it doesn't turn around and bite you. You know? And I'm sure there's lots of people who found out the hard way. But yeah, you know, let's do our own thing.
Yeah, we're watching, my wife and I are watching old Crocodile Hunter episodes, and I'm literally watching, biting my nails. I can't even believe it. Like, I'm just like out of my chair. Like, I can't even believe they're getting away with this. And I'm telling my wife, like, honey, if he was on YouTube, if he was around when YouTube came, it just would have blown up. He's sitting at the bottom of the ocean floor feeding a frenzy of sharks, and, you know, trying to hand feed them and all the close calls and stuff like that. But I will say a lot of it, I will say, I know that some of that stuff is sensationalized. Of course, it gets the ratings, but he brought millions and millions of people around the world. He brought awareness of some of those misunderstood animals. So I think he, such a legend. And did you ever meet Steve since you were around the same time? You never did.
No, I didn't. And it's a real shame, because, you know, there were opportunities, but we were...
Opportunities? You know, what happened? Well, did you say you were busy?
We were just so busy. I mean, because the fact that we were both on big networks, we were always just doing other things. And when he was doing, you know, a festival or something, the opportunity was there, but we would all... You know, I was running the wildlife park and trying to make TV shows. And so it got just, you know, time was just, there wasn't enough time, and it would always be like, man, that opportunity just slipped by. So, and of course, you know, no one expected him to to disappear on us so fast. So it's a shame for sure.
So you do the 6-part series Insects from Hell. Did you enjoy the whole experience filming a show?
You loved it. Yeah, I mean, So what happened was, you know, as I said earlier, I had this vision of travel, adventure. Suddenly, here I was, first series, 6-part series, was in Africa.
Right?
So here I am, flying out to Africa. I'm in the Kruger National Park, where we're hunting down elephants so we can find fresh poop, so I can go and lay in it and get all excited with dung beetles. It was the first thing I ever filmed. You know, I remember, I mean, I actually had some panic attacks, because I, you know, it all happened so fast. I really wasn't prepared for it. And so I remember, you're in Kruger, We're hammering down these side roads with an entomologist from the Kruger National Park, so that we've got, you know, our guide. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Leo Brock, his name was, South African guy, and great guy. We find the elephants, we find some fresh poo. I get out there, and the scene is going to be me walking in through the bush, finding the dung and laying down in it, and then there's a close up of me, you know, doing my thing. And it was very ad-libbed at that mm-hmm. point, right? It's like a magazine-style show. I was the expert, so it was like, you know, I'll just do what I do, and then the editor will take it from there. But I had this panic attack. I'm suddenly standing there, and I looked over, and there's 13 crew, right? Because we've got I think we had five or six crew of our own at the time. And then we had a whole bunch of other people with us. So we had guides. We had rangers there with guns, because we were out in the Kruger. You know, there's no fences or anything, so that we have a couple of guards with us, or rangers. And then we have a scorpion expert, because we wanted to make sure if we came across species I had no idea about, we would have the facts right there.
Yeah.
So we had like the, you know, African scorpion expert with us, and a arachnologist, and a Dr. Leo Brock, the entomologist. And so all these people, and I'm going to walk up, you know, get all excited. And it just suddenly hit me, the gravity of what I was facing.
Oh.
And it hadn't really hit me up until that point. And I'm like, shit, this is it. I'm like going to perform now in front of all these extremely educated, you know, professional people. And I thought, I have no place being here. It just hit me like, what am I doing? This is, you know, complete imposter syndrome. But at that moment when it was about to happen, you know, the camera guy was about to call action. And I just start, I mean, it's hot anyway, but I start doing that thing where you know, for me, it's like my forehead prickles like crazy, as sweat's trying to burst out of my skull. And you know, my hands start sweating profusely, and my heart goes. And it's just this massive, you know, well, not a massive panic attack, but probably a mild panic attack. But it was pretty, pretty hardcore. And then it was like action, and I just had to let my instinct take over. And the take that's in there is that take. You know, we didn't redo much stuff. We would if there was a very good reason, like there was a problem with audio, or an aircraft went over, or something happened, you know. But a lot of the time we use the takes, the first takes, and then we just write on to the next thing. And that meant getting bitten a lot by, you know, praying mantids and things. Like, I'd be holding this big praying mantis, and I'd be looking at the camera and looking back and talking, and not, you know, this one particular time my thumb was a little too close, and this praying mantis turns around and just starts serrating, you know, through the end of my my thumb, and I'm like screaming. And of course they use that in the show. They're like, this is great stuff, you know.
Yeah. Can I say, there's nothing more intimidating presenting animals in front of experts or people in the field. Like it's the worst, and sometimes you feel like that. It is literally the worst, because it's like you almost sometimes second guess yourself. You know what I mean? Like,
even
we were just filming at the Taronga Zoo in Sydney, and I remember we're filming with kangaroos. I have filmed with red kangaroos so many times on and off sets. I've done this before, but I'm talking to the keepers and I'm asking questions for them, because I'm setting them up to make them look knowledgeable, this and that. But even then I was like questioning like my facts to make sure, like, okay, this is right. And it's like, because it's their animals. It's the animals are always around. It's the worst, and they're the sweetest people. But when you're dealing with the experts, were they like kind? I mean, did you end up getting over that, or was it still intimidating, like presenting a scorpion in front of South Africa's scorpion expert?
Yeah, that never is not intimidating.
It's
always intimidating. I mean, but what happened was, what was really nice was that they all, you know, when you're a TV host, mm-hmm. there's a preconception, I think. And what was so nice is I think that everyone that I ever really met when I was traveling the world doing that as a TV host would say to me, wow, you are not what we expected at all. Because, you know, I would never go up and say, hey, I'm a TV presenter. You know, I'd go, hey, I'm Jake. How's it going? And I hang with the crew. It's just like that. That's who we are. It's what we do. We're not like prima donnas off, you know, preening ourselves, but there is that kind of that you know, preconception. And so what was really nice is they would tell me about that preconception, right?
Yep.
So these experts up were having a beer that evening, and they'd say, you know, it was so nice seeing the way. So actually, this was a different day. I was handling the scorpions, getting some advice from the scorpion experts, picking up these scorpions, putting them on at my hand and talking about them. And that night they said to me, you know, it was so wonderful watching you. They said, you just know what you're doing. You know how to handle them, not to spook them. It's such a pleasure, because we thought it was going to go a different way, you know. And they say, you totally know what you're doing. And when you hear that from people who have spent their life, you know, studying these creatures, it makes you go, oh, well, that's cool. You know, that's great. And also, one of the things that I heard from many scientists, which also kind of makes you feel good as a wildlife expert.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know this because you're the same, right? Wildlife expert. Is that when you speak to most of these scientists, they've been studying one or two species their entire careers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a few come to me and say over the course of about 8 years, a few come to me and say, you know, what makes you so different and your expertise so special is that you know so much about so many things, from the tiniest insect to some of the largest predators. And they're like, we have no idea. Like, I'm a mosquito, Anopheles mosquito expert, and I only know about mosquitoes. And I heard that a few times, and I'm like, yeah, you know, it's good to, when you're in our position, it's very good to remind yourself that and go, you know what, I'm here for a reason. When that imposter syndrome creeps in, I'm here because I do have something to offer. And I have to remember that and go with the flow. And I think the most important thing is to never bullshit your way through, right?
Yeah.
It's like if you don't know something, you don't know it. And so I learned that very early on with working with kids, is that kids would ask me stuff and I go, you know what? That's a really good question. I don't know that, but I'm going to make it a point to look that up later and find out. And that was back in the days before the internet was really a thing. And so now I'll tell people it's great and I'll look it up and then I'll post it or something. But I think that's important. Yeah.
I think it's being so authentic too. Like I don't know that. Let me see. You know, because not everyone knows everything. And I think it's so important to learn. You can learn so much from those experts and from those scientists. Stuff that you can't even find. I mean, you literally can't even find on the internet. I remember one animal I've been presenting for years and years is the African penguin. So we'll bring an endangered African penguin on the Today Show. I could spit off a million facts about African penguins. But when we were there in November, my wife and my parents and I were in Simonstown and we were kayaking with the penguins and they're swimming around us. Everything's wild. And we're listening to the local guide and he's telling me things about penguins I have never heard in my life. And my mind is just blown. Like, I'm getting chills thinking about it. Blown. Like, I'm just like, I feel like this guy Terry knows more about these penguins that anyone could ever research. And it's just, it's just interesting getting all that insight.
Simonstown, I think that's where they filmed
Octopus Teacher.
Penguin Town.
Oh!
Oh, well, and Octopus Teacher, but Penguin Town.
Oh!
Do you know Netflix's Penguin Town by Red Rock Films?
I haven't seen that. I need to add it to my list.
It's a good family one. It's like following groups. They're like little gangs of the penguins walking around. It's from the penguins' perspective and just like going into town and... called Penguin Town.
They are my
favorite.
And I
have to, before I forget, just going back to something you said earlier, you were at Taronga Zoo. Did you meet Hayden Turner?
No. Is this someone I needed to meet?
So, well, Hayden, funnily enough, he was a Nat Geo presenter the same time as I was. And we ended up doing a world tour of speaking for Nat Geo.
Oh, what a dream. Dream job for a world tour for Nat Geo. Oh, yes, please. Oh, man, that's great.
And he did a series. So he was a keeper at Taronga Zoo, but I believe he's their education officer now or their outreach officer.
Oh,
still there.
Really?
Australian guy. Yeah, great guy. Mm-hmm. I went to, I think we went to Poland and maybe Singapore. We went to a few places and did talks. He had a series, which I don't remember the name, but it was like a postcard diary type show where I think they would give him $1,000 and he had to go and film a particular thing like the monarch migration. And so he had $1,000 to get from Australia to the place and film them with that $1,000. It was a great show.
Wait, so that was like part of the show? Like he only had $1,000? That is so cool.
So it's like, I've got $1,000, and he'd be like in the office kind of thing. I've got $1,000. I'm going to go and film the Monarch migration. Not the whole migration.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and film the Monarchs, you know.
Yeah.
And so he would set off, and he would do little diary. It was very much kind of vlogging. I mean, he had a camera guy with him, but it was kind of like a vlogging show. And back then, of course, that kind of style was pretty new, so...
Yeah, no, I did not meet him. Yeah, I couldn't recommend the place enough. Taronga Zoo was great.
Yeah, I've never been.
Oh, you've never been?
Spent a lot of time. No, I spent a lot of time. I spent a year and a half in Australia.
Oh.
Gosh, about 30-odd years ago now.
Wow.
And then I went back to Canberra to film kangaroos for a series, Rograders, which was all about the animals and human-animal conflict, basically. And you know, the road traffic accidents with the giant kangaroos. Gosh, terrible stuff.
Yeah. Did you enjoy Australia?
Oh, yeah. I tried to move out there.
Really?
To be honest. Before, I was 22 years old.
Mm.
I went there for a year of escaping, you know, escape life, travel to Australia, see the world.
Oh, man.
And I ended up, I was a bricklayer's laborer 4 days out. I didn't have any money when I got there.
Yeah,
bought a ticket, got there with no money, ended up in a $6 a night hostel.
Oh.
And the next day a guy walked in and said, hey, we need bricklayer's laborers. So I'm like, I'm in. So I started earning money, bought a motorbike, tried to travel around Australia on a motorbike. That didn't go very well. Sold the bike when it kind of clapped out. And then ended up just doing lots of jobs. Waiter. I was a Harley Davidson chauffeur in Airy Beach for 3 months, which was fantastic. And after things like that, I mean, Airy Beach, just stunning beaches. The Whitsunday Islands are close by. It's just, you know, tropical paradise. So I thought, I want to live here. So I then, after the year, it was 13 months, I went back to the UK. And then the only way to get out there after you've done, you can only have one of those travel visas once. And so after that, it was like, okay, how do I get a job to move to Oz? And it was either, I think top of the list was brain surgeon or second was chef. And I'm like, brain surgeon, chef. I'll go with chef. I trained for 2 years to be a chef, moved out to Australia. And to Perth, I had a job in Highlight 33, which is a revolving restaurant in one of the skyscrapers in Perth. But before I started the job, I had this dream. I had had a dream since I was about 8 or 9 years old when I owned a newspaper and saw a whale shark and a diver. And I'm like, I have to do this. I'm 1,000 miles south of where they come into the Ningaloo Reef in Perth. And I thought, before I start the job, I'm going to head up and go and dive with whale sharks. So I got up there, went out on the boat, had this epiphany with a whale shark, which was just unbelievable. I had a little CNC Instamatic camera, jumped in the water, waiting, ducked down, waiting, and then all of a sudden this just majestic beast comes through the water.
Oh.
And I've got my camera up trying to take pictures, can't see a thing, my lenses are fogged up, can't see anything. All of a sudden I feel I'm being pushed through the water, and I let go of my camera, and the corner of the mouth is in my kind of solar plexus here, pushing me through the water. As I move away to the side, we have this split second looking into this eyeball, and I just start crying in my mask. I'm so overwhelmed with emotion, tears just streaming. And I realized, what the heck am I doing? I had the chance to work with wildlife at the wildlife park in England, and I was kind of trying to escape it in my, you know, like escape life kind of phase. And from that second on, I got out the water. I went and handed my notice into a job I hadn't even started. And I went back to the UK and went back to the wildlife park.
Yeah. And then, and then that's when the TV happened, because you were still young.
And then the TV happened. Yeah. I was 30 years old when that happened. So that was, about eight or nine years later.
It's so crazy. And I know listeners can't see this interview, but when you were describing the eyeball of the whale shark, you like held up your hand and it looked like you're holding like a nectarine on how big the eye was. That is a bucket list for me. Yeah, I really want to do that.
Yeah. You should.
I need to go during the time of year. I also, you know, did some research on you. You did a lot of work in the Great Barrier Reef. Oh my goodness, spectacular!
But I would say that, you know, the Ningaloo Reef is across the other side of Australia, sure. So on the west coast.
Yeah.
And I would say it's more pristine because it's just, it's much harder to get to. So it's, you know, between the two of them, I enjoyed my time on the Ningaloo far more.
Really?
Because it's just so, the Great Barrier Reef is incredible, but it's so overdived. There's so many boats out there that, I think it's just a lot of destruction going on, you know, at the time. And hopefully things have changed with the reserves and what have you. But
I mean, ours were, we loved it. My first time, my wife and I going to the Great Barrier Reef, and it felt like I was swimming in like a big fish bowl or like this big, big aquarium. I've never seen so many fish in my life. I just, it was great. I noticed though, so much coral bleaching. I mean, it's hard not to... It's hard not to not notice it. Like the corals weren't colorful in a lot of the areas. No. Did you notice that?
And that's really the difference I mean between the two. Ningaloo Reef had very little of that bleaching. Yeah, and a lot of it, they at the time, and I'm sure there's more research that shows something, you know, more now, but at the time it was very much, they were talking about sunscreen. You know, so many people, you know, with sunscreen on going in the water, and they're all just... It's like congesting around these reefs that it eventually just kills them off. But also people standing on them and, you know, the fact that so many people out there who'd never dived before could do, you know, a couple of hours in a pool and then head out to the Barrier Reef was, I think, one of the biggest issues.
Oh,
because... You know, just new people who really weren't divers going out, and it's just tourism and getting people out. And then, of course, they can't find neutral buoyancy, so they're landing and bouncing on the coral and stuff like that. So,
See, my wife and I just snorkeled. We are not diver certified, so we just snorkeled. So and we picked a great Great Adventures was our tour company. It's an eco tour. It was great to have a little area sectioned off and stuff. But no, we weren't actually. Would you recommend getting scuba certified? Because is that where like all the exciting stuff is going on down below?
Well, it depends what you're after. I mean, you know, snorkeling in the right places, you'll see probably more fish than going scuba diving in much of the time, because there are just some of those reefs that are just so heavily, you know, they contain so many species that are living around using those corals for food or for, you know, for their environment, their safety. The difference really is that you're just going to see different things. I mean, once you scuba dive, I mean, I you know, we made a show about the sardine run, the largest school of fish off the coast of South Africa. Wow. That thing can be seen from a satellite image. It's so big.
It
basically looks like an oil slick. So it's about 10 kilometers long by about 2 or 3 kilometers wide. And that's where you get all that bait ball footage you see in shows where, you know, that's what we were out there to film, a bait ball with dolphins bait balling them and then sharks and gannets and tuna. That kind of stuff you can only really witness, you know, diving. That's extreme. That's going to the other end. That's the largest congregation of marine mammals in the world, you know, fish and mammals, the sardine run. But yeah, it just gives you more flexibility. I think, you know, you're just going to see new different things by doing that. I mean, there's so many places you go where there's nothing to see when you're snorkeling because everything's just at depth. Obviously, if you're taken to the right places for snorkeling, then that's fantastic. But yeah, definitely worth doing.
Yeah, I can't recommend the Great Barrier Reef enough.
It's beautiful.
It's so cool. You just like sit there and watch these communities and you just see everyone just working together and you see the parrotfish and you see just the big angelfish and it's great. It's great. I have to say, I feel like though some of the brochures, you know, you see those fancy brochures and they promote the Great Barrier Reef of like you swimming amongst like a sea turtle that's like a Photoshop. Right. I have to say like that moment didn't happen for us. They were pretty skittish, but we did see a sea turtle off in the distance, which is nice.
The diversity there is just incredible, and that's what makes it so astounding. Is you get in the water and the diversity of fish, the variety you see, is just amazing in those colors. And of course you lose those colors as you go further down, right? So
yeah,
you know, the water starts cutting them out, so it gets very blue the further down you go. So that's why snorkeling is so good for coral, because yeah, you get to see those colors you wouldn't see at depth. So
I feel like I need to add this new reef to our places to go. Maybe the Great Barrier Reef is getting all the exposure. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, Ningaloo is incredible.
Ningaloo, how do you spell that? Do you know?
I believe it's N-I-N.
N-I-N-G-A-L-O-O.
Ningaloo. Might be 1-0. Yeah. Ningaloo.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's way up there on, I mean, if you know Australia, right? So you pretty much, if you go from Perth, you know, there's not much in the middle at the bottom. You get to Adelaide, and then of course everything's on the coast pretty much there. Mm-hmm. You go up, you've got Cairns, and then when you go across, there's not much again until you get to Darwin. Darwin is on the kind of top peak of the west side. Between Perth and Darwin, there is not a lot, and that's a long way. I mean, we're talking probably 1,200, 1,500 miles, right? It's a long distance on that west coast. But that's what makes that west coast so incredible. There are beaches there. I remember a little place called Denham that I went to, and you could walk out about a quarter of a mile into the ocean and still be like knee height in the water.
Wow.
And it's just this golden sand, white golden sand with turquoise. I mean, it's just mind blowing, and there's no one there.
Oh.
You know, that's what makes that place, because it's hard to reach, you know. But
yeah,
of course, I'm talking about 30 years ago, so a lot could have changed in that time. I'm sure there's been a lot of development north of Perth.
Yeah, I want to go to the western side because Darwin is like the capital of all the saltwater crocodiles.
Yeah.
So that is definitely on the list. Well, really quick, let's talk about kind of fast forward, because you just got done filming Urban Black Bears with Planet Earth 3. How in the world does that work? That seems like a dream. I mean, that seems like a dream scenario right there. Did they reach out to you, or you reach out to them, or how did that end up?
Yeah, they reached out to me because I had been filming Black Bears up there for about 18 years now. So after, you know, when I moved to the US, I met my wife here. I moved out here in 2007. And I kind of moved behind the camera at that point, because I was in a place where I, you know, traveling the world, presenting, fantastic, never really wanted to be a presenter. And the more I was in TV and I saw the roles, I'm like, wow, I'd love to be a camera person. I'd love to have be on the creative side. And so I picked up a camera and started filming, and, you know, have made multiple shows now for local clients, national clients, international clients, as well as networks. And I met my wife filming black bears for one of our National Geographic shows, Rogue Raiders again, in Tahoe. Now, I met her when I moved out here and got married. I continued filming black bears, and they're on my doorstep, right? Urban black bears. So we're talking about black bears coming into our urban environments, and they come in for our trash. And so it makes for some great footage and some incredible scenarios. So I kind of became known in the industry as kind of like the urban black bear filming specialist, if you like, because I've got a huge stock library over the years of filming them. And so when there was this gap that they wanted to fill in Planet Earth 3, and it was very much about the episode is called Human. It's the 7th of 8 episodes of Planet Earth 3, which just came out in the US in December. And the DVD, actually, in the 4K and the ultra high definition discs just came out, I think, a week ago. So it's now available to purchase. When they were after that, they found my footage and they came to me and said, look, do you think it's possible to get this, 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 and this? And I said, 95% yes. And the rest is obviously up in the air. And so, I was commissioned. I spent 3 weeks out filming every night. This is all nighttime, so it's all from 9 at night until about 4 in the morning, and got some incredible footage. And it ended up being its own little sequence in Planet Earth. And, you know, what was so nice about it was that they reached out to me. This is right during COVID, actually, when we were filming. But they reached out and said, you know, you're really keeping office morale up because all of our other BBC crews aren't allowed to travel. And because I was on my own filming, you know, on my own, I was able to go out and film and send rushes back. And they're like, you are the only person in the world right now sending footage back for Planet Earth 3.
Wow.
So it was like literally, yeah. And actually on my my new episodes of the podcast coming out shortly, I have Freddie DeVasse, who is the producer of that episode. And he actually talks about that in the episode. So.
I can't wait to listen to that. And I can't wait to see Planet Earth 3. It hasn't come out on my end yet. It hasn't come out on Netflix yet.
Yeah. So it's basically what it is it's a BBC show, right? Sure. So it goes out in on the BBC, BBC One primetime in the UK. Done that. It then aired here on BBC America. So you have to have a bundle that has BBC America, which I think is bundled with AMC Plus.
Okay.
So if you get AMC streaming, it's $8.99. You get Planet Earth 3 in that. But now what happens is once it's done its rounds on the BBC channels, they will eventually license it out. So I guarantee at some point it will be on Netflix once Netflix license it. And, once that time comes.
I love the Planet Earths. My goodness, my favorite. And it's still narrated by the famous David Attenborough.
Yes. Oh, it's his last.
Oh,
he's 97 years old. Oh, no, it's not his last series, but it's his last. I mean, this is what I was told. It's his last in the field. He went into the field to do a couple of clips for it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the last series that he's actually going to travel. The rest, he's still narrating tons of shows, but that's all studio based. So, yeah. I mean, that was a dream come true. Like I said, as a kid, we had box sets of Attenborough.
Yeah.
So for me to work on an Attenborough show, he's narrating my footage.
Oh.
And Hans Zimmer has composed the music for it. You know, one of the biggest, you know, Hollywood composers of our time. To me, it doesn't get any better than that. I don't think I can top that. So,
no. Did you get to meet David, or did he send you a letter?
No. I do have a signed image somewhere from him, which is nice, a title card. But no, because it was all done remote. Yeah.
I mean,
I was here filming. He's there in the UK. So hopefully one day.
I need to write him a letter because if you go on Instagram, he will write you back. And people are all my wildlife friends have their David Attenborough letters. And he even gave my buddy Bo some like wildlife filmmaking advice. He took the time to watch this independently filmed wildlife documentary and sent back notes. Like he watched the thing, which I thought, okay, wow.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, he's a great guy. And what I love is that you can't contact him by email or DM.
No, you can't.
Or, you know, it's a handwritten letter. And I love that. It's like, hey, I'll answer you, but it's got to be a handwritten letter. And I think that's great.
I think so, too. That's great. Well, as we are wrapping up, and I know this is interesting. I went to your website and you offer courses on how to become a wildlife presenter. What are can you give me your top tips, maybe top three tips on if you want to pursue a career in this field for us?
Sure. And so, typically it's really about becoming a wildlife filmmaker as opposed to presenting.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind of like an all round filmmaker, as many of us are these days.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you've got to get out and you've got to film, right? I have a lot of people who reach out and become part of our community. We have a community called the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Community. It's actually a free community.
Oh, great.
So people can sign up. We just opened that this week. One of the things is I'll get people reach out and say, so how do I do this? It's my passion. It's my dream. And I'll say, what have you filmed? And they'll go, oh, nothing yet. And I'll be like, you know, a passion and a dream is something that you do regardless of the outcome. Right. So first of all, you've got to film, got to get out there, film it. In this day and age, we have no excuses. You know, Vimeo, YouTube, put your stuff out there, get it out, get feedback on it. Show people what you're doing. That's the second part, right? You've got to film, you've got to put it out there and show people what you're doing. And really the third part is persistence, perseverance. You've got to then really network, right? Because networking is what gets people into this industry. If there's any one thing that's going to drive you into the industry or get people to, you know, respond to you, know you even exist, it's networking. And it's one of the hardest things to do in this industry, because it means you really do need to be either part of a community that's talking to each other, or you need to go to festivals. You know, Jackson Wild, Wild Screen, International Wildlife Film Festival, all of those festivals cost money to do it. But it's like any career, if you really want it, then you do have to, you know, put something into it to get something out.
Can I add a fourth? You ready for it?
Yeah.
I bet you already have it. I would say be nice to everyone, because you don't know who. You don't be a jerk.
You don't know.
They could be your boss one day, or they could know someone who knows someone. I would just say be a kind person. Yeah. You know,
I saw something that Gary Vaynerchuk said the other day.
Yeah.
And he said now, meaning right now where AI is starting to grow rapidly, he said, what's more important than hard skills is our soft skills. Hard skills being, you know, our knowledge, our training, all of those things. Soft skills being empathy, kindness, you know, the things that just should be part of who we are and how we, you know, enter the world. Those are more important, because all the knowledge-based stuff is going to get taken over very quickly by AI, right? Not all of it, but a lot of it. What we need to do is be empathetic towards other people, you know, show our kindness, be out there, be great to be around. And in the wildlife filmmaking industry, if you want to travel the world with a crew of people, you got to be a person that's easy to get along with, wants to be part of it, passionate about helping out in whatever way. You know, if someone says, hey, can you go and grab me a coffee? Or, hey, can you, you know, clean off the camera bag because we're going to need it tonight? Or can you do it? Yeah, of course I can. Absolutely. I want this production to be the best it can be. The worst thing is being on a production with people you just don't get along with. You know, it just brings the whole thing to a grinding halt. So, yeah, soft skills. Yeah, be kind, be nice, be good.
I love it. I love it. Well, Jake, thank you so much. Will you join us for the after show?
Absolutely. Be my pleasure.
I'm so excited. So in the after show, I'm going to ask you some of your favorite places in the world that you've been to. You've been to over 38 countries, and I'm going to also ask you your favorite wildlife encounter. Now, if you want to join and listen to the full interview, you can join the after show by just heading over to patreon.com/animals to the max, and we will head on over to the after show. Now, before we head to that, is there anything you want to remind listeners? Can they follow you online? Can they, I mean, of course, listen to your podcast, Behind the Lens podcast? Anything else you want to steer people to?
Sure. First of all, it's Behind the Wild Lens.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, Behind the Lens.
Okay.
I've been saying the wrong podcast.
There's a lot of them called Behind the Lens.
Oh, no.
But this is specifically Behind the Wild Lens. That's all right.
I hope they're all appropriate.
We've got that out
the way. Okay. Behind the Wildlife Lens. I'm putting a note
behind
right now.
Behind the Wild Lens, yeah.
Oh, the Wild Lens.
And it's actually, that's rebranding, because it has been the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast for the last 48 episodes. So we're rebranding right now. It's going to be called Behind the Wild Lens. But yeah, if you head on over to Jake Willers, that's WILLERS.com, really you can find everything there. There's a page there for the podcast. There's the social media links, and there's also the community link, so you can join up to our free wildlife filmmakers community. And I also do mentoring as well on a weekly basis, and all of that information's there, jakewillers.com.
That's amazing. And we'll put the links in the show notes. Okay, let's head on over to the after show. Thanks for listening to the Animals to the Max podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. Also, if you haven't already, hit the subscribe button. It really helps me out. As always, if you have any guest suggestions, if you want to email me personally, head on over to CorbinMaxey.com. And if you haven't already, check out our social channels. You can follow me at CorbinMaxey on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We'll talk to you next time.